Little Benji boy is itching for some fun and games.
Hello and welcome to Marvel by the Month, a weekly journey through the history of Marvel Comics. My name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And we, for the very first time, are joined by a couple of guests. How about that? So we have Levi Buchanan and Jess Kranz, the co-creators of Pink Hearts, with us. Thanks for joining us, friends.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So Pink Hearts is a comic book that is currently in Kickstarter. You launched the Kickstarter last week.
June 25th.
So tell us a little bit about Pink Hearts.
Yeah, Jess, how about you go?
Well, I've never written a comic before, but I've been going to karaoke forever and ever. And that's where I met Levi. And we started writing it in September. And we wanted to make it really inclusive and welcoming instead of like a comic that's just by dudes about dudes or something. Like, we wanted people of all genders, like people of all sexualities, like people of all races, like everything that we have found in the karaoke community, because it's so welcoming and inclusive.
That sounds awesome. So it's set in a karaoke bar. Like, what's the premise?
Yeah, so Pink Hearts is the name of a fictional karaoke bar in Portland, Oregon. And so the premise is that we catch up with a young woman named Kailani. We start with the worst day of her life. She has just finished signing the divorce papers with her ex-wife, Issa. And she's going to Pink Hearts to meet her best friend, Tom. And what's key here is that Tom is the only friend that's hers. That is not like, that was not part of her marriage.
The
that
couple
was not
friends.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. And so she goes to Pink Hearts to meet Tom. It's, like I said, it's one of the worst days of her life. The last place she wants to be is in a karaoke bar where, you know, you've got drunk frat boys screaming, you know, Santeria. And then quickly discovers that's not that type of karaoke night. And Jess is exactly right. That's what, you know, we wanted to do, is we wanted to make a comic that reflected Portland's very cool, very welcoming, very vulnerable karaoke scene.
That sounds awesome.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. If folks are interested in learning more about that, they can head to pinkheartscomic.com. I'm sure there is a link to the Kickstarter on there. And welcome to our podcast, which is exclusively about comics written by white guys.
It's and, not as inclusive.
Yeah, where there are absolutely at this point no characters of color, unless you count the Hulk
or the Thing.
Or the Thing. Yeah, he's an orange American, so.
They're halftime, you know, white guys. So
yes,
let's just say it.
Well, so let's jump into what we're going to be talking about. So this week on the podcast, we are covering comics that had a cover date of November 1962, which means that they were on the stands in September of 1962, which was kind of a busy month in American history. The two big stories that were happening at the time, a little thing called the Cuban Missile Crisis was about to heat up. The Soviet Union was secretly shipping ballistic missiles that could reach the U.S. to Cuba, and they were intended to be able to deliver nuclear warheads. And the U.S. would find out about this in the not too distant future. Tensions with the Russians were already very, very high, and it's really just about to get worse.
So when you hear commies, which you have on every episode of this,
yes,
you understand again why. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And then closer to home, a really pivotal moment that would kick off a lot of domestic strife. James Meredith was the first African-American student who was intending to attend the University of Mississippi, which was segregated at the time. The Supreme Court basically said in September of 62 that there's no reason that he should not be allowed to attend. Justice Hugo Black said that he could do no appreciable harm to the university. The governor of Mississippi at the time, Ross Barnett, responded with a 20-minute address on statewide television and radio to urge state officials not to obey the federal court order. And this isn't exactly comics related, but I think it's really important to remember that this is something that was happening in living history. The governor of Mississippi literally said, "We will not drink from the cup of genocide. There is no case in history where the Caucasian race has survived integration." This is not the ancient past. This is what's going on, you know, in the country and in the minds of the people who are reading these issues. So as we, you know, get a few months further down the road, you know, you're going to start to see some of these things reflected in some of the stories that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and, you know, other Marvel Comics writers and artists are telling. And there's a reason for it. So I think it's worth mentioning.
On a happier note, on the 23rd of September, the Jetsons premiered.
Oh, so we had that going for us.
A all white family in the future. With, you know, a robot maid and a fun dog who's also a robot. So
Cameron, does it say what year the Jetsons takes place in?
You know, I'm not sure. It says 100 years in the future is okay. What I know of.
Yeah, so it'd be somewhere like 2060s something.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if it was going to be like one of those fun
there's
things.
There's still time for it. Like, okay. Yeah. We're not in
vague
Star Trek
21st
1
century.
Now.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, like how in The Running Man is like now. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly. All right. Well, let's jump into it. We have 5 issues to cover this week. We're going to talk about Fantastic Four number 8. Incredible Hulk number 4, Journey into Mystery number 86, featuring Thor, Strange Tales number 102, featuring the Human Torch, and Tales to Astonish number 37. Rob, you want to kick us off and walk us through what happened in Fantastic Four this month?
Let's do the lightning round of Fantastic Four number 8. Woo-hoo. So the cover introduces us to the creepy-faced puppet master, and he is controlling some puppets of the Fantastic Four who can't help themselves. The puppet master is making them attack each other. As we begin, we see our usual domestic disputes going on with the family of the Fantastic Four. The Thing, Ben Grimm's trying to come in to Reed's lab. Johnny and Sue are holding him out. He gets very upset, starts moving people out of the way and getting ready to clobber Johnny. The normal thing. So then we get to Johnny, of course, starting to fight back because they're just like the two kids fighting all the time. And I don't know how they have any furniture. But Johnny puts a flame circle around Thing, and then Reed, of course, breaks it up, which is always the case. This time with the fire extinguisher instead of his usual, like, just holding Ben by wrapping around him. Ben is annoyed and leaves, but Sue follows him. And Sue is trying to, you know, calm him down and bring him back. And then they see a person climbing a bridge and about to jump off. So they know they can't reach this person in time, so they fire the Fantastic Four number 4 flare. And Reed and Johnny get into action. Johnny gets there, makes his hands not flamed on, and brings that person to safety. And that's when we see somebody's finger on a doll. And they get their finger burned, and it is the Puppet Master. And we get to part 2, the hands of the Puppet Master.
Yeah, so the Puppet Master is a unique looking individual. He doesn't really look human. He looks sort of like Billy Corgan with horse teeth and false eyelashes. He's quite a looker.
Like an angry doll with, you know, the hair ripped out.
Yeah, he's got the real exaggerated features of, you know, of a marionette doll.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's kind of got pretty eyes.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure he would appreciate that.
And he lives with his stepdaughter, Alicia, who is blind. She doesn't realize that he's up to some bad shenanigans, but it turns out he has radioactive clay. And when he carves a figure of someone out of the radioactive clay, he can make them do whatever he wants. Because radiation, there's nothing it can't do.
He figures out that it could only be the Human Torch who's caused him some trouble. He decides he's going to make a figure of Ben Grimm and makes the Thing walk to his house, not knowing that Sue is following him. So Sue slips in right behind him. But quickly, the Puppet Master figures out she's there because Alicia, she can hear another heartbeat beat and another person breathing. So she mentions it, which only gets everyone gassed with ether.
Can I also just point out at this point that the Puppet Master has an ether dispenser built into the wall of his house?
Yeah.
And it's labeled ether. It's like, what?
That's a straight up villain stuff right there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to imagine like an innocuous reason that one would have this, or like
it's got sleeping problems. I don't know.
Yeah. How do you hire someone to install something like this for you?
Even creepier, he decides he's going to have dress Alicia up exactly like Sue and send them both back to the Baxter building. Then we see the second part of his plot, which is the, is it called the deputy warden of, or the personal trustee of the warden of a state prison. He controls a puppet of that person and has him basically release all the prisoners of the state prison. Meanwhile, the thing under control and Sue get back to the Baxter building and start a ruckus, which really isn't that unusual. The thing just trying to punch Johnny is an everyday occurrence, but this time he's not under his own control. So Thing smashes some furniture, smashes into the lab, but then falls upon that secret that he was being kept out of the lab for, which was a formula that Reed's working on to help him become a normal, non-Rocky Orange human again. He falls into this fluid and becomes human. He is very happy about that. And he is so thankful to Reed, and his all of his gruffness just melts away with the rocks.
And this also breaks the spell because he no longer looks like the Puppet Master's puppet. So.
Right. The key plot point.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hey,
yeah.
Thanks. That's what I'm here for.
So he makes sure that Johnny's okay. He's taking a, you know, pretty good punch at him. Alicia comes in, and she'd hurt him earlier and touched his face when he was at the apartment when he was the thing in Rocky. She hears his voice as a man and thinks he sounds similar but different, and finds him and touches him again, and right as he changes back. So this fluid dried up and he became the Rocky thing again, and he is very sad about it, although she thinks he's wonderful that way. Back to the prison. Everybody's breaking out. Meanwhile, the, let's call them the boys, they arrive to fight a giant puppet robot. So they overpower this robot, but the Puppet Master and Alicia, dressed as Sue, are flying off on another puppet of a winged horse. Reed manages to grab her off the horse, and Puppet Master's like, I don't care. I'm out of here on my flying robot horse. That's when they finally learn about this prison break and head that way. We have a crazy plan by Johnny to melt through the walls and a bunch of ground and come up underneath them and snatch the warden away. Meanwhile, the thing runs into action, and part five is an awesome shot of him just ripping a prison wall open and just throwing a prisoner through the air into a pile of sand. Then he makes a cage out of cell doors just by bending it and throws it over a bunch of them. And then we see some more of Reed's powers. He gets shot with a bunch of machine guns, just makes the bullets fly back at them.
Which is, I mean, those two panels of where the on the bottom of, what is that, page 21, where so the bullets sink into Reed and stretch all the way back. So he looks a little bit like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
And then they thwang back out. And I love that it's like the final, you know, panel on that page. And even though I remember, I mean, I know I'm aware of the era and the limitations on violence, but there's that part of my brain, I'm like, is there going to be some straight up murder in the next panel? Because he has flung dozens of machine gun bullets back at these guys.
But in a G.I. Joe way, everyone somehow ducked in time.
Exactly.
Reed snatches the guns away from these guys. We also see the team working together pretty well.
And then we go back to the Puppet Master's apartment, where Alicia has realized what her stepdad is up to. He shows up again in just the creepiest way possible, like peeking through a door that's open like an inch or two, and he shows off a puppet he's made of himself dressed as a king, and then he goes on this kind of extended fantasy about what he will do once he has control of the world. He will have kings and leaders serving him. He'll have the Fantastic Four enslaved and pulling him along in kind of a racist rickshaw scene.
It's not good.
It's not great, but he's not good either. So it's okay that it's not good.
And it's kind of funny the way in which the puppet master envisions himself as a king and like in different outfits.
Yes.
Like in each panel. Like first he's kind of like,
depends on
like
where he's
at. An English king, like kind of like Dave Gahan in the Enjoy the Silence video. And then he's kind of got the Kublai Khan thing going. And then the very, very unfortunate final panel where the Fantastic Four is pulling him in a rickshaw. And you're just like,
But then Alicia grabs his hand. They struggle for a moment. He knocks her to the ground, but the puppet of himself goes flying. And then that leads to him tripping and stumbling and falling out of a window just as the Fantastic Four burst into the apartment. And that is the end, of the Puppet Master. There you go. That's Fantastic Four number 8. And now we're going to skip over to Incredible Hulk number 4, which has two stories. The first is called The Monster and the Machine. And this one starts with the Hulk strapped down to a gurney with a giant, awesome-looking Kirby-designed machine pointed straight at his head. Rick Jones is desperately trying to figure out a way to save the Hulk and Bruce Banner's life. With this machine. Then we see the army testing out what they are calling the iceberg rocket. This thing is designed to freeze they test it out on a robot duplicate of the Hulk, which they launch into the air, and they launch this rocket at it. The rocket sprays this icy substance, which immobilizes the robot and sends it crashing to the earth. And General Thunderbolt Ross is very excited that this is going to be the way that he's finally going to get rid of the Hulk once and for all. His daughter, Betty, has been reminiscing about her experiences with Rick Jones and the Hulk and Bruce Banner, and believes that Rick Jones knows something about Bruce Banner's whereabouts, and knows something about the Hulk as well. General Ross puts out an APB for Rick Jones. The scene switches back to Rick and the Hulk hiding out. And remember, at this point, Rick Jones still has the ability to control the Hulk mentally, which is a weird thing that didn't last very long, thank God. So the Hulk, he orders the Hulk to escape, and Rick gets taken into custody by the army. The Hulk rescues a school bus.
Which might be the first time the Hulk does something good.
Yeah.
I don't know. He usually doesn't do anything good. Bruce Banner solves the problem. Hulk is just a pain.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Or Hulk is actively trying to destroy the human race and accidentally fails to do so. Then Hulk winds up on a movie set not too far away, shows up at the craft services table, demands food in what might be my favorite panel of the entire month. And then we see, we cut back to Rick being led away by some army guards in a Jeep. And in the rear view mirror is a jolly green giant approaching closer and closer. And the Hulk can fly now for this brief period of time. It's not just jumping, but he can like literally fly. I feel like Stan and Jack were just throwing stuff at the wall to see if they could figure out how the Hulk worked. And this is what they came up with. So the two of them hide out in a cave for a little while. Rick is trying to figure out how to get the Hulk to turn back into Bruce Banner. He's got this device, which we saw at the very beginning of the issue. The Hulk tells him, basically, give it a shot. So he turns on the device. Hulk turns back into Bruce Banner, but he's very, very weak. Then they make some adjustments to it so that he can turn him back into the Hulk, but he'll have Bruce Banner's brain. So we'll see how this goes.
Is this kind of the introduction of like the Professor Hulk?
Yeah, this is definitely the first time that he's a smart Hulk, but he's also got like this very belligerent attitude still. So it's somewhere in between the two. So he's got the intelligence of Banner, but he's still got like this kind of savage aspect. He decides to again try to do something heroic. So he saves a family from a burning house. And winds up terrifying them. And then the sheriffs show up and start shooting at him. And Hulk decides that, well, that's the end of him ever trying to do anything nice for anyone ever again. Goes back to their cave, gets shot with the ray again to turn back into Bruce Banner. And that's the end of this weird story. If you're keeping track at home, the Hulk started out switching back and forth at sunup and sundown.
He's like a werehulk.
And he was still fairly verbal. Like he could still put a sentence together as that first Hulk.
Yeah. And then and now he can turn back and forth basically at will, but he needs this device to do it. But he still hasn't gotten to the point where anger does it yet.
Right. So, and this device apparently emits a lot of gamma radiation still, too.
So yeah, because Bruce Banner looks like hell every time he comes through it. So that's the first story. The second is called Gladiator from Outer Space. So this one kicks off with a spacecraft unexpectedly swooping down from the skies. An alien gets out of it, who calls himself Mangu, and he challenges Earth's mightiest warrior to come and face him. Bruce Banner and Rick Jones see this on the TV. They decide that they're going to accept the challenge, use the magical device to turn Banner back into the Hulk. They charter a private plane. And they fly out to the desert where Mangu is waiting for them. But as they arrive, a bunch of red Soviet soldiers come out of the woodwork, and it's a trap. Mangu is not an alien warlord. He is a Russian soldier who's hiding inside of a robot suit. These commies think they've got the drop on the Hulk, but that's not exactly how it works out for them. He makes very, very short work of these guys, catches a grenade in one hand, lets it blow up in his hand, gets shot at with a sonic cannon, winds up burrowing under the earth and coming up underneath the guy who's firing at him.
Classic Bugs Bunny. Yeah.
Yeah. And just wrecks house, destroys the landing gear of a rescue chopper that comes in to try to pull them out of there. And then he winds up gathering all the soldiers together, taking their belts, tying them all together. And then tying them to the helicopter and basically telling them to leave and never come back. Hulk takes off after that. The army arrives. They see the wreckage of the battle. They realize everything was a hoax. But they think that it was the Hulk who set up the hoax. He did it to try to look like a hero. Instead of the fact that he, our greatest American, just repelled a Soviet plot. Again, we're back in the cave. Hulk turns back into Banner with the gamma ray device and is looking rougher and rougher as Rick Jones leads him away. So, kind of a couple very random Hulk stories this month. But
which isn't unusual for the Hulk. Like we have very random stories for him.
Yeah. It's a comic where Kirby didn't quite stop doing just straight up monster comics. So, which is what he had been doing for years prior to all the superhero stuff. So, they still haven't really transitioned Hulk into being a superhero character yet.
Let's get this thing moving.
All right. So we got three short ones now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can take Journey into Mystery.
All right.
Starring the mighty Thor.
Let's see what he's up to.
On the cover, we have Thor trying to defeat the Tomorrow Man, but he can fade into a different year before Thor can reach him. We open up on a full page panel of Thor surrounded by robots. And you know how I love the weird Norse god with sci-fi mix. So this is a pretty good story for me. It's on the trail of the Tomorrow Man is what this is called. We have the Tomorrow Man saying, "Behold, Thunder God, you pursued me into the future only to meet your doom at the hands of my steel slaves." So we do get to see one of the coolest Kirby futures. So we get to see a lot of weird curved things that are classic Kirby, including the time machine. So we see the future is peaceful. It's 300 years in the future. Everybody's happy. Nobody has a problem except for this one guy who isn't a evil scientist named Zarko. And he just wants to rule the world. And so he decides he's going to go back in time with his, it's referred to this at one point, time cabinet. And and find a terrible weapon. So scanning through the past, he finds, of course, a nuclear bomb and decides that's the place for him. He's going to go get one of those, bring it back to the 23rd century, and rule it. Meanwhile, we have Thor, who is helping the U.S., I assume. I don't think they're mentioned specifically, but I think I see some insignias to test some of their missiles. So anti-missile missiles.
Yes. And I love on the end of the second page, here's a quote by Thor. "I'm happy to play a part in keeping the free world strong and secure against the forces of tyranny." Ooh. So for a Norse god, Thor is a hell of an American.
Yeah, he is really committed to democracy and the American way. So he flies after a missile, manages to fly a little faster. Everyone's fine with that. They're using Thor to test, you know, how fast their missiles should go.
It should have one Thor power.
Yeah. They're like, if it can go faster than Thor, we've got a good missile. So they start strapping some electrodes and things to him for the next test, which is the most dangerous of all, which is to have Thor stand in front of a bomb. And
the cobalt bomb.
The cobalt bomb, which they call the C-bomb, which sounds like a swear word being, you know, yeah. So for the rest of the time, it's referred to as the C-bomb, which looks like a cool Kirby egg bomb. He's standing there waiting to have the thing blow up in his face. It's counting down, but that's when the time cabinet appears, and Zarko jumps out and grabs the C-bomb and heads, jumps back into it, and heads. This is where, but the time cabinet dematerializes so swiftly that Thor's hammer harmlessly passes right through it. So once I saw time cabinet, I was like, how can you not say that?
Yeah.
All the time. Cabinet. Thor gets his hammer back. He's fairly upset because how can he, you know, possibly fight someone who can travel through time?
Which they make the most amazing logic jump in single panel. Like, he just disappeared. He must have gone through time.
Yes, obviously.
And I think that was a pipe smoking member of the armed forces.
Kind of a John Kerry looking.
Yeah.
He's the one who's like, it must have been moving through a segment of time.
Is this the part where we point out that Larry Lieber wrote the script for this one?
Yeah, we usually.
So Stan Lee did the plot. His brother Larry wrote the script. So, and you can. You can tell a Larry Lieber story.
Yeah, you don't need to throw Larry under the bus. He lives under the bus. And so Thor decides, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask Dad to help me out with this whole time travel thing. And this is where Thor starts acting a little bit more like Thor and not lame Dr. Blake. So he actually contacts Odin, talks about Asgard, asks for the power to travel to the future. And Odin's like, sure.
He's like, you already had it.
Here's a fragment of strange metal. Tie it to your hammer. Fly in the future, man. Do it. And
it's also, it has one of my favorite Thor tropes, which is Thor needs to talk to Odin. So Odin's gigantic face appears in the sky. Like, it's awesome. Like,
yep.
Anytime the king of the gods shows up, taking up the entire horizon. It's a good day.
Very Kirby, very Old Testament.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Agreed. We see Thor. I don't even know how he worked this out so fast, but he can nail the time, the mysterious time in which the time cabinet has gone to.
Oh, no. It's because he's got a piece of the metal. He knocked a chunk of metal off.
That metal is how he's doing it.
Exactly.
With Odin's blessing. Right?
Yes. So. Yep.
Thank you, because that was another piece of logic I thought Larry had left out. But so Thor whirls his hammer, travels through time, passes 2013, 2086, notably. So we know he's headed to the 2300s, where he appears, asks people what year it is, 22, or that's the 23rd century, 2262. They ask who he is, think he's handsome. We get to see some more cool Kirby fashion and Kirby whatever machines, but Zarko figures out pretty soon that he's there, sends some people to seize him because he now has the ruler. He's got a nuclear bomb in this formerly peaceful world. But before these guards can capture him, this black cloaked figure throws a whole tree in their way. So weird, but that happened. And then Thor continues after Zarko, but gets classic trapdoor gag. He gets dropped into through a trap door into some magnetic mirror room where he gets slapped around for a while. So that's it. You know, it looks like Zarko's won. However, a hammer flies in and crushes Zarko's remote control weird device for his magnetic mirror room. And it is the real Thor who was the guy in the cloak who threw a tree in the way of those cars. And he has some decoy guy who dressed up as Thor, who's been slapped around in the magnetic mirror trap door place. Don't know where that guy came from, if he came with him from the past or if he met him in the future. But then he's trying to get the cobalt bomb back. He gets shot by a Delta Electron gun, which starts to send him into a different dimension, which is a pretty cool gun. It seems like he could have used that the whole time. If you have a dimension shifting gun, you could just threaten a few people with that, take over the world. You don't need to go get a C-bomb. But anyway, before Thor gets shot into another dimension, he blows a hurricane force wind back. So this is sort of classic Superman style. That's just another, we learn all kinds of cool Thor powers every issue. He makes it back through the dimension and knocks, I think it just shuts off the device so Thor can make it back through. And now we're at the beginning of this issue where Thor is surrounded by giant weird Kirby robots. One, which grabs his magic hammer, which seems previously impossible, apparently holds on to the hammer and doesn't slam down to the ground. And now we have the countdown of 60 seconds before he turns into lame Dr. Blake.
Which is one of those things I completely forgot about Thor, that there was this temporary period where he could lose his, like, the hammer was required for him to be Thor.
Yeah, it was in that era where every hero needed to have a secret identity and some bizarre random kryptonite type weakness. And it actually lasted way longer than it should have. Like, as soon as they just kind of got rid of the Dr. Blake thing, Thor became a much cooler character.
So wrapping this up, Thor digs in the floor before his time runs out, gets some water on the robots. Naturally, not water-resistant robots.
In the future, no. No, yeah. No waterproof robots in the future.
I forgot his name. Zarko.
Zarko.
He jumps into a spaceship with his C-bomb. Thor makes a giant storm and knocks the spaceship asunder, which shakes loose the C-bomb, and Thor catches it. The spaceship crash lands. Zarko is captured. 23rd century thinks Thor is awesome. He whirls his hammer around again, brings the C-bomb back. Everybody's happy. Jane Foster then sees Dr. Blake, tells him about how cool Thor was, the usual. He's like, if only you knew how awesome I am when I'm Thor. That's the summary of everything he says whenever he's Dr. Blake.
Yep.
And there we go, the end.
Yeah, Dr. Blake has no personality except not Thor. I think one of the reasons this is a really good Thor story is because Dr. Blake only shows up for the last three panels and just like walks through a door, and that's his entire role in the story. So yeah, less Dr. Blake, please. Go through the Human Torch story in Strange Tales 102. So this is the Prisoner of the Wizard. So this is the first appearance of the Wizard, who will wind up being actually a fairly major Marvel villain. But at this point, he's not much of anything. So we get a recap of the Human Torch's exploits from the previous issue. And as everyone's oohing and aahing over the torch, this rather unique looking individual says that the Human Torch is indeed mighty, and it'll be interesting to match my powers against his.
Hey, wizard, why the long face?
Hey!
Very Rasputin-esque.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. The space between his nose and his upper lip has got to be like 4 to 6 inches. Yeah. Just weird, grotesque Kirby face that he instantly identifies him as the bad guy. Like, it's shorthand for bad guy.
And that's the thing is, and it's something I think I'm grateful that we're getting away from a little bit more in popular culture, where deformities, scars, things like that are shorthand for, this is a villain, this is a troubled person, this is the bad guy. We're a long way from it, but we're getting much closer to where that's shorthand
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I, you know, the way the way that I will frequently describe Batman is he's a rich guy who had a bad thing happen to him that he never got over. And so now he goes around beating up deformed people.
That's a fair summary. So yeah,
fairly accurate. This guy, the wizard, maybe the reason that he has this kind of enormous melon is because he has such a gigantic brain inside of it, because he winds up going back to a home that he designed himself, which looks very, very futuristic. He has all sorts of devices in there that are years ahead of their time. He has an invention called the air chair, which is just a cloud that one sits on and reclines while reading a newspaper, or I'm sorry, a scrapbook filled with newspaper clippings of all the awesome things that he's done.
Bit conceited, wizard.
Yeah, just a bit. He is a leading contender for the International Chess Championship.
I love that the chess computer actually has to have two robot arms to move the pieces, these little T-Rex arms versus just having a human subordinate.
Oh, that yeah. Tells it. And legs and a butt so it can sit in a chair.
And a head as big as a fifth of a refrigerator. Like easily.
Because it's got a giant brain.
Yeah, I mean.
How else are you going to do it?
I understand now that the head is that large.
Right. But yeah, so he plays chess against robots and wins. He gets himself wrapped up in chains and locked in a safe and dropped in the water and escapes.
Yeah, unexpectedly, he's also an escape artist and magician.
Yes,
yeah, so as well as an inventor.
So he's a Houdini. He's a future furniture designer. He's a chess champion. And he's going to be the man who defeats the Human Torch just because. So he sets up this elaborate plan where he's going to drill into the center of the Earth. He fakes a breakdown in his machine that makes it seem like he has been trapped down there, knowing that the Human Torch cannot resist the urge to be a hero and come down and save him. So the Torch rescues him. Wizard invites him back to his super fancy house. Winds up spraying him with a bunch of chemicals that douse the torch's flame, except for his head, because as soon as the torch winds up in having solo adventures in Strange Tales, all of a sudden he has a secret identity. So you have him completely extinguished except for this burning head. So he looks a little bit like an early version of Ghost Rider. And then the wizard, he unveils a plan where he's built a suit that will allow him to duplicate the look and powers of the torch. And he goes on a crime spree.
So I cannot be burned.
Yes.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, it's a completely...
Just mesothelioma, it's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. So the wizard, disguised as the Human Torch, melts his way into a bank, steals a bunch of money, busts a bunch of prisoners out of a jail. this is maybe my favorite bit. He sets up a toll gate of flame on a bridge, and he charges cars $100 to go through his flaming gate. And then winds up melting a statue, sky writes with flame in the sky, down with law and order. Just having a grand old time, just wrecking the torch's reputation. But what the wizard doesn't know is that now, after a certain amount of time passes, the actual Human Torch's flame returns because the solution has dried. And even though he's in an asbestos-lined room, he can crank up the intensity of his flame to melt his way out. And now it's on. He gets attacked by the police and firefighters of the city, who believe he's the bad guy. He winds up evading them and tracking down the wizard. The wizard says that he will meet him back at his house. He knows that the torch will never harm an unarmed man. But he says, if you will come to my house tonight, I'll be waiting for you for our final test of power. So the torch goes along with that idea for whatever reason. And he comes back to the wizard's house later that evening. The wizard has photographic evidence proving that he was impersonating the Human Torch. This is evidence that will clear the Torch's name. The only way you can get the pictures is by using your flame to kill me, and I know you won't do that. Or you can turn your flames off, and you can fight me man to man, and you can get them from me that way. Or you can do nothing, and I'm just going to throw the pictures into a fireplace and burn them. The Torch says, I'm not going to do any of those things because I have an additional power. I can make things move without even touching them. And sure enough, the photos float out of the wizard's hand, which perplexes the wizard because he had no idea the Torch could do something like this. But of course, the Torch actually can't do it. It is his sister, Sue Storm, the Invisible Girl, who did it for him. The police come, they take the wizard away, and that slightly bizarre Human Torch solo adventure. We got one more to go. We got an Ant-Man story.
Tales to Astonish, number 37. We have Dr. Henry Pym as the Ant-Man. On the cover, we see that he is defying the unknown protector. Protector is got a nice Hulk palette of green and purple, wearing a scarf and a nice beret, some green goggles. So you can't see his face at all, a gray mask underneath that. We find out that each day 1,000 tales are etched in the city. Ours begins as a jeweler named Gerald Marsh staggers to his feet, and we hear the wail of an approaching police car. All of that information, we are reminded, is communicated back to Dr. Pym and his lab by the network of ants that are monitoring all the police activity.
Do we want to count dubious scientific claims in this story? Because there's one.
We can't. Yeah, I think that might be fun.
Okay.
So Henry Pym puts on his Ant-Man suit, reduces himself with reducing gas, and jumps into his special cannon to fire himself over to 523 Elm Street, where there is trouble.
Okay.
So here we go. He's hurling through the air, and he, while he's doing that, a bunch of ants are amassing to catch him at the jeweler's store.
Right. And so he is able to launch himself across town with such precision that he can land on the awning of the precise address in a pile of ants.
Yeah.
So that's two.
Maybe now we should cover... We know that when he is ant-sized or small-sized,
yeah,
he is supposed to have the mass of a human, normal,
yeah,
full-sized man.
Yeah,
he can knock a person over.
Right.
So he's just massacring these ants as he lands is the only way that could go down. So he lands in a pile of ants and just, I would guess, shoots through layers of them before stopping. And, you know, I don't know. He seems willing to sacrifice some, but that's cold. So he talks to the he reveals himself to the jeweler, talks to him about what's going on. There's this guy called the Protector who beat him up. Apparently the Protector's game is to ask, it's a protection racket. So right. If you've ever seen any mob story, he says, you need protection, and they say, you got to pay me for protection. If they don't pay him, he messes up their store, and what he does is takes some weird ray gun and turns their jewelry and their cabinets into sand.
Yeah. So let's be very precise about this. He destroys half the cabinet as well as all the jewelry in there.
Yeah.
Because this will be a plot point later.
Yeah. Okay. Which seems weird because, you know, he could just take some jewelry, but instead he turns it into sand,
right,
apparently.
Yep.
With his electronic disintegrating gun. We could maybe call that one another science if.
Sure.
So Ant-Man, you know, he's going to find this protector. So what he decides to do is, one, track a few things he finds in the store, has all the ants looking out for the protector, has all the ants communicating back to him.
Yeah, he basically sets up ant Google alerts,
yeah,
for words like protector and disintegrating
that is
ray.
Exactly what he does.
So that's four?
Yeah.
Okay.
So now he eventually locates another incident of the protector through his ant network, fires himself from his cannon across town again, lands in, I think, a baby carriage.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Cause he's again, like flying through the air. The streets are crowded. His path to the anthill is blocked. he'll crash into someone unless, wait, that baby carriage.
Which is empty, I hope.
Which hopefully is empty. Otherwise, he's plowing through a baby.
Yeah.
Yep.
Land on a pile of babies and see how that goes with the comics code. Then he does some other weird stuff by jumping into a trouser cuff.
Yeah.
He's always doing something to like get somewhere faster and not turn back into normal size. He takes a swarm of ants in and he confronts the protector who's, you know, holding up another jewelry store. He has the ants bring him a pearl necklace, which he breaks on the floor for a classic slapstick gag of the protector slipping and falling. But then he said, let's finish this outside where there's more room and where he can find more ants.
He literally says where I can find more ants to help
me. So does this like ant network, like they can hear the police and stuff?
Apparently.
They don't know from the other ants that survived the massacre earlier. Like, do they not hear about that and say, we should stop supporting him probably?
No, well, he's got a helmet that controls, that communicates with them and controls them. So he's basically forcing these ants to massacre themselves so that he can...
And or hang out at the police station or, whatever. Like, just they, and then there's donuts.
Seems ethically questionable.
It is ethically questionable.
Oh, yes. I do like the fact, though, that so Ant-Man basically says to the protector, let's take this outside. And the protector literally defeats him with a squirt gun.
He steals a squirt gun from a kid and shoots Ant-Man, who almost falls into the sewer because he just got shot by a squirt gun.
Because God forbid he should just like grow to be a foot tall.
He gets some ants to get a lollipop stick and bar the grate of the sewer so that he won't fall into the sewer. Close call. And then he rides an ant home. I don't know how long that takes. He goes up his tiny elevator inside his wall, and then he hatches this plan, which is to make his own jewelry store and I guess sell jewelry for like a week until the protector comes to do this protection racket thing. Yep. So that's weird. Protector comes, starts to shake him down, does his whole protector thing, blasts the cabinet, reducing it to dust.
Again, disintegrates half the cabinet. This is going to be important.
And it says, you know, pay me $300 a week or I'll use this gun on you. Hank Pym stands there, whatever, lets him leave. Now he changes to Ant-Man to follow the drops of machine oil he sees coming from the protector. When the protector entered the shop, he sent electronic impulses with the button he had under the counter so that he could have some ants get onto the protector's boot. It's really weirdly elaborate.
See, if you turn the crank and that kicks the boot, it sends the ball
down
the chute.
Everything he does is a Rube Goldberg.
I was going to say.
It's just bizarre. So an hour later, he figures out where the protector is. It says that. He breaks into an old tenement building, only to be immediately sucked into a vacuum. Which is sealed.
So far, Ant-Man has been defeated by a squirt gun and a vacuum cleaner.
Saved by a lollipop stick narrowly. So the protector takes the vacuum bag, glues it shut. Bam. He has just captured the Ant-Man. What he's not counting on is that he has the strength of a normal sized man. So he punches through the paper bag. Good job, guy. He finds a fan on a table, blows the dust from the bag into the eyes of the protector, and meanwhile has the ants at the police station spell out with their little ant bodies, Ant-Man, Protector Vacant Tenement, Evans Road, gives them the address, bringing the police. So that has happened. The police show up, and then we find out what this is all about. The original jeweler, Gerald Marsh, is wearing a sort of robotic exoskeleton to make himself bigger. And let's see, help me out with this, Brian.
Right. So they said, the police say, but what about that disintegrating gun of his? And then Ant-Man says, even that wasn't really what it seemed. You remember how it caused a puff of dense smoke? Well, under cover of that smoke, he stole the gems himself and dropped some grains of sand in their place. But he disintegrated half of the cabinets.
He also had a replica half of a cabinet. And he apparently, in that cloud of smoke, moved out the full cabinet. It's hard to say, but it's a plot hole. But, you know, needless to say, Henry Pym has saved the day once again by punching through a paper bag and not
falling down a storm drain.
What a weird hero.
Also, the ants do a lot for him.
The ants do everything for him. Yeah, and he has ants doing things that I'm pretty sure ants can't do.
Yeah.
Like, we stopped counting the scientific dubious claims, but I'm pretty sure ants can't spell.
Yeah.
If he relies on ants so much, then maybe he's Cant Man.
Oh my God. Sitting on that one for a while.
Yes.
So is that the kind of wordplay that we can expect from Pink Hearts?
As a matter of fact, no. I don't think Jess would let me get away with anything remotely like that.
So probably not. So how did you guys, first of all, come up with the concept, but also like become writing partners? Is this the first thing you've worked on together?
Yes. You approached me in September about it, and you were like, I want to write a comic. And I thought you just wanted to write a comic. And you're like, no, I want you to help. And I want it to be about karaoke. And I'm like, do you have other ideas? And you're like, maybe magic, but probably not. And then we started writing it then, and we got sidetracked for a bit. And then we finished it earlier this year. I found an artist, Melissa Capriglione.
Yeah. So Melissa she's a phenomenal, phenomenal artist. Like, I knew from looking at her webcomic called Falconhurst, and it's about a supernatural boarding school, and it's spelled Falconhyrste, and I highly recommend checking it out. It is wonderful. When we were looking for artists, I think it was her use of color that just blew us both away.
She's very talented, and she's really great at capturing expressions. Like, she's worked with us to develop the images of the characters, which Levi and I had talked about as we were writing, but she brought all of them to life for us and was really receptive to like our suggestions. And we have her designing some images for the Kickstarter, which will fund the rest of the comic so that we can actually put this thing out.
Yeah. So a bit of an origin. So like, as Jess was saying, so karaoke has been a big part of my social scene. You know, you meet some incredible, amazing people, such as Jess, you know, through this scene, because it's a community of people that are inclusive and supportive and vulnerable. And that's one of the things that made me really fall in love with it. And I wanted to do a karaoke story, but I knew that I didn't want to do one that starred a 40-year-old white dude. I could not go down that route again. And I knew, because Jess has a degree in poetry, you're saying, and I knew Jess is one of the most creative people in my life. And it just became very, very clear to me in talking with her early days that there was no way that I could do this comic justice, do this idea without her.
I wanted to say earlier, when you were talking about like the events that inspired like some of these comics in the 60s, like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the high school integration and the commies that show up everywhere. Like, we're sort of doing something similar with Pink Hearts, because this administration is so hard to live through. Uh-huh. It's hard enough for you guys, but as a queer woman, I cried like on election night. I know a lot of people did. Uh-huh. It's hard to thrive and hard to live in an administration that is so hostile to people of color, to trans people, to non-binary people, to disabled people, to the queer community, immigrants, like everyone. It's terrifying if you are part of any of these groups. And in karaoke, like, one of the places I went right after the election was probably karaoke, where I found my friends and we sang it out and we felt really good and I felt like I belonged. And like, when I moved to Portland 8 years ago, karaoke was where I finally found like 95% of the people I know here. And it's such a diverse group of people that I don't think I would have encountered in any other situation. And we know so many people of varying like identities. Like, I'm bisexual, I'm a woman, I have disabilities. Like, it makes me feel welcome to be able to express all of those things in this community. And they're like, yes, come here. Like, we love to hear you sing. Like, we want you to do this. So we tried to make our comic reflect that reality and to like shut out all of this administration. I don't want to say his name. And to make this a space where our friends, where like everyone can come together and feel like they belong to something, that they're safe, that they're seen, and that they can feel like loved and respected for who they are and not asked to change a thing. And like the voices aren't old white men taking away people's rights. The voices are young queer people, people of color, trans people. Like, we didn't want any of those voices in this. Like, we wanted a place where that's just muted so that these people can find a voice. Like, maybe people who can read it and they're not in Portland where we have something of a liberal bubble. It's not perfect. It's kind of racist. It sucks. But like, people in the Midwest where I'm from, where I definitely felt really estranged in a red state as like when I came out as bisexual, I'm like, oh, I don't belong here. This is not great for me. This is not going to go well. Like moving to Portland, I was like, okay, this is where I can be. This is fine. But people who are stuck out there, like queer teenagers who were like me when I was 15, can read this comic and be like, oh, thank God. Like there's hope. There's places I can go. There's people I can meet. There are groups that will welcome me as I am. Like, not everything is what I hear on the news. Not everything is going to be everything that's being shouted at me all the time. Like, there's this.
We had a few pillars when we were writing this. You know, in the beginning, we wanted it to be inclusive. We wanted it to be uplifting. We wanted to represent, you know, multiple people that did not look like us. And I really think that it's the right story for right now. It's about finding community. It's about chosen family. You know, Kai is about ready to give up on Portland because she feels like she doesn't belong there. She left her native Hawaii to come here for her wife who was going through grad school. She gave up so much. And then when that marriage ends and she feels like nothing here is for her and she's about ready to leave, she discovers this place and discovers these people that have similar stories to her, that have similar experiences, that welcome her immediately. And that gives her a cornerstone for what's going to be her new chosen family, her new community in Portland.
I mean, that's kind of what we found at the night it's not based on, which is Baby Cat and Karaoke, which like Portland's huge karaoke thing. Yeah. It's been in the New York Times. I found that community when I moved here, and I loved that it was not just going to a bar and singing karaoke. Like, a lot of people have a really negative view of karaoke, and I hosted karaoke in college. It was like a strip mall pizza place in Omaha, Nebraska, but not Omaha, in the suburbs. And I was this 22-year-old in a cute hat, and I went over and I would have the 6-year-old guy sing Pink Floyd and touch my thigh and call me babe. And I'm like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
And I would have like this woman who always sang Love Shack with her gay best friend. And I like every week it was just like a rote recitation of these same karaoke songs. And it just made me kind of depressed. And I was like, I love singing. I love music, but this is just not it.
Right.
But I still wanted that. I love performing and I wanted that outlet. And so when I found Baby Kitten, I was like, oh my God, this is next level, because our friend John Burphy like makes his own tracks, like finds the actual studio recordings, like, and he's incredible with sound and makes everything sound so full and so lush. Like, he brings out the best in every singer. He knows what effects to use on your voice to make it pop. And he can like make a whole night turn to a dance night. It doesn't feel like removed and distant and just like a bunch of drunk people warbling to, you know, Santeria. It's something that's so much better than that. And I hope that Pink Hearts kind of conveys that and maybe makes people not have a bad taste in their mouth when they say karaoke.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds awesome. And yes, please, everyone listening to this, support Pink Hearts. Go to pinkheartscomic.com, get on that Kickstarter and throw a bunch of money at it. I want to see this thing come to life. We have already contributed to it, and we hope you will too. So, Rob, what would you say, looking back on the issues that we covered this week, what mattered about this month?
Well, in FF number 8, we talked about this. We actually texted about this recently. The Puppet Master and Alicia Masters are introduced. Both become major characters in the FF universe and crossover into other comics as well. But Alicia especially, like, I don't care about the Puppet Master, but her relationship going forward and her love of Ben Grimm is wondrous.
Introducing her as a character is where Ben Grimm stops being just a horrible mopey monster all the time.
Yeah.
And it gives him a third dimension that he really needs. So.
And it's another character with a disability that does a lot more in the universe than people. I mean, over time.
Yeah.
Than absolutely. People would think.
Yeah. And I mean, also, she's one of very few prominent female characters in the Marvel Universe at this point. And she actually gets some really interesting things to do in the not too distant future.
How about Hulk?
Well, and then, yeah, Hulk. So this is the first appearance of the Smart Hulk or Professor Hulk or sort of the kind of Gray Hulk personality. And so it's the first time Stan's kind of playing around with Hulk having Bruce Banner's brain. Although the whole issue does kind of feel like Stan is just continuing to throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. He's still trying to figure out how the Hulk works or how to make the Hulk work as a character. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, but so this is issue 4 of the Hulk. The Hulk only goes for 2 more issues and then it's canceled.
Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So
we never hear from the Hulk
and
again.
We never hear from the Hulk again. That was it. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, they're still trying to tweak the formula and, you know, he's flying. He's got Rick Jones controlling him. Now he's smart and he turns into the Hulk when the ray gun hits him. And yeah, so they're still trying to work it out, but at least a lot of what happens in the early Hulk issues, other writers years later come back and revisit. Like Peter David has a run on the Hulk where he pulls from a lot of these things. John Byrne does some stuff. So this is all kind of like they're seeds that take a very, very, very long time to bloom. But something does come from them eventually.
In Journey into Mystery, we have the first appearance of Zarko, the Tomorrow Man. And the first glimpse of that future 23rd century Marvel Universe.
Yeah, it's the first time we've seen the future in the Marvel Universe. We've seen the past when the Fantastic Four went back to steal Blackbeard's treasure. But this is the first time they've gone forward.
Yeah, and we see that Thor can travel. He can do more with his hammer than we thought.
Yeah.
He can ask, you know, for some help from Dad.
Yeah.
And get powers we could not imagine so far.
Except for the power to put it down.
Yeah.
Right. Well, he can't let go of the thing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
He does put it down. He's got 60 seconds. I mean, there's a lot you can do.
Yeah.
You can spray water on robots, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah, you can heat up a cup of coffee. Yeah. And then in Strange Tales 102, the wizard shows up and he eventually gets a suit of armor and he winds up being a real pest with the Fantastic Four. He becomes, I don't know if I'd say an A-list villain, but like a B-minus list villain.
Yeah.
He never gets cool, but he's around, so that's something, I guess. Nothing happened in the Ant-Man story that is worth anything. Let's pick a panel of the month here. Something that wraps it all up. I'm going to go first, and because I'm going to steal this before you can, because I know you love The Incredible Hulk, but I'm stealing the panel from page 7 of the second story, and the panels 5 and 6. It's in these panels, one of the commie soldiers throws a live grenade at the Hulk. He catches it in his hand and just holds it, and it blows up. And then he says, "Do those commies think they're playing with kids?" It is just like such a tough guy thing. Like, it's so like rah-rah. Like, you might as well have had like the Blue Angels flying overhead and like a giant American flag waving behind him.
That was his, like when Thor is, you know, testing the missiles with the, you know, it's his moment to really shine for the U.S. Armed Forces.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, the Soviet Union really was trying to
There was a huge exterminate threat at that point. So,
What do you got, Rob?
Well, weirdly, because usually I'm like, Hulk stopped a Jeep and people flew out of it, and that's my favorite because Kirby drew it in a tiny panel and it looks beautiful. This time, it's the tender moment of Alicia with her hand on Ben's face as he transforms back into the thing. So there's really two panels. It's FF number 11. Page 13, panel 3 and 4. So in 3, he's a human. She comes and touches his face, says, "Your voice, you are the strong, kindly one, but you seem different now." And then he begins to turn orange and rocky. And she says, "No, wait, I was mistaken. It is you. It is the same wonderful man." So as he becomes the thing again, she is more enamored with him. And that's really the that seed, I think, of their future together and as they interact.
Yeah.
So, yeah, me, I'm doing the tender moment this time.
That's awesome.
What did you think?
Yeah. Last thing we do is just to decide how marvelous the month was. And this week we're going to use a scale based on various modes of transportation. So at the high end of the scale, we've got a dimension spanning Uru hammer. At the low end of the scale, we've got a catapult into a pile of ants. where do you put this month?
Oh, man, that's hard. There are some great moments, but Puppet Master is not one of my favorite villains. Mm-hmm. And I think he's the most well-rounded here. So I don't think we're quite, I'm not going to say it's catapult into a pile of ants. No. It's better than that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's not like jumping into a trouser cuff to, you know, get walked into a store. So I'll go with dimension spanning Uru hammer. I mean, we got to the future. We got to see some Kirby robots. It's all right. Yeah.
I like you, I'm sort of torn. It's not falling into a pile of ants. It's better than that. I think I'm going to go with the Hulk and Rick Jones chartering a private plane. So it's like, yeah, we're
with not, full-sized Hulk too.
Yeah, we're not going to another dimension, but we are like good at, you know, it's a mode of transportation that resulted from what must have been an incredibly awkward conversation. I think it was a good effort, but, you know, not over the top. Thank you both, Jess and Levi, so much for being our very first guests on the podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And please definitely be sure to head to pinkheartscomic.com. Back this Kickstarter. Get this thing made. We want to read it. We want it to be out there. It is an important thing. And I know it's going to be awesome because awesome people are creating it. And you can find us on the internet if you are so inclined to do so. Hit us up at marvelbythemonth.com. You can email us at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth, Twitter at marvelbtm, and Facebook at facebook.com/marvelbythemonth. Until next week, I am Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Mill.
And we will see you next week for next month.